and welcome to 10 Very Big Books, a Malazan read-through podcast. My name is Peter Bond, and with me today is our special guest, Iskar Jarek. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm doing good.
He has returned once again. If he was on our Memories of Ice spoiler cast, and he is the man about town for Malazan on the YouTube.com. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is always like the sign that you didn't screw it up too bad the last time. This is even a bigger honor, I think, than being invited the first time.
You get the double dip.
That's right.
In the offseason, we talked about Carsa Orlong, and I talked about how I don't really like his character that much. And we can get to him a little more later, but we also talked to Steve, and Steve came in very hot in the interview. He came in with a point to make, and a lot of it had to do with colonialism and how he was trying to process some ideas about colonialism when he was approaching the Bitathol storyline. And that interview will be out later. I don't need to recount his whole argument. But it was interesting to hear. But near the end of the interview, since we had a little exchange.
Yeah.
A little fun time, me and Steve. And, you know, we had turned off the mics, and then we were just catching up about other stuff and how everyone was doing before we left. And I told Steve that ultimately, I think I'm a bit more of a moral scold than he is, you know? and although sometimes I think I disagree with some of the things he writes in his book,
yeah.
You know, I just think that's a separate thing, because to me, these books are certainly not in the moral scolding business, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's obviously things the books are portraying as bad and don't, you know,
are
very ungenerous to.
Yeah.
But I would never even say they're scolding those things, you know?
Sure.
It's a very removed angle
yes.
to approach some of these things. And
witness.
I think, yeah, and I think for me, sometimes I told Steve, being so removed about some such severe things leaves me feeling very conflicted, which I think is a perfectly fine feeling to feel when reading a book, you know. So I'm not even that worked up that he's making me feel conflicted or anything.
Right.
But I just think it's, I don't know. I guess that's all to say, I really wish the rebellion would have won. I guess that's what I wanted to say.
Ouch, yeah.
I don't know. So I guess welcome to the show. That was how I was going to frame it. It made more sense at the start of my sentence.
I love it.
So what do you make of House of Chains? Let's start there.
Yeah, House of Chains, honestly, I was going back through because you guys are actually ahead of me by about a book now, because I'm still going through Memories of Ice on my videos. And so I had to go back and do homework, and I had like two major reactions, because I'm kind of in your camp. I'm not a huge Carsa Orlong fan. It's weird because I don't like the Carsa Orlong character necessarily as a person. Like, there's people out there who are like ride or die Carsa Orlong, you know, and there's actually ride or die Kalor people, you know what I mean? And like, I don't like him like that, where I'm just like, dude, I'm such a go Carsa type character. But I do like his arc, because I think that there's a whole social commentary going on with Carsa's arc, and kind of, you know, I feel like I grew up with people like Carsa, or I know people like Carsa who are, you know, and I watched another podcast that talked about certainty, you know, and I thought that was a perfect theme to talk about, because he kind of comes out of his village and tribe with so much certainty, and he has his like grandpa. And I think that whole dynamic between his dad and his grandpa and him, and the living up to the legacy kind of element, and having that also be kind of a House of Cards stuff too. But, you know, and you see that kind of over time get chipped away at, basically, where that, you know, young 18-year-old or however old he is at the beginning, Carsa, has just such a dead set 100% knows exactly who he is and what he's doing view of the world, and he goes out and does all this stuff, and that just, you know, erodes pretty dramatically over time, and especially throughout the remainder of the books. He never becomes like this great guy and he's this awesome, amazing person that everybody wants to go out and give a high five to, but he does undergo a pretty tremendous change. And so I never find myself going, yeah, this guy's awesome and I want to go hug this guy kind of thing. But I do I do think he has a pretty incredible arc as a character.
So let's just get into the Carse of it all, because it's so funny. We're releasing this episode the same day we're releasing a great episode. I actually think it's one of our worst episodes, but that's a whole side point. But we read Steve's Problem of Carse of Orlong essay, and we like tried to talk about it, you know? And in it, I kind of talked about why I don't really like the character that much. And part of it is I just like can never really get on board with having fun with him, because I think some of the pleasure is like, and then he kills the Daragoth. He's like a cool, you know, we're supposed to revel in how badass he is. Is something we're asked to do a lot in the books, you know,
which Carse is a badass. I mean, there's that.
Yeah, no, he definitely. And I even can see that I do. You know, I'm, you know, sometimes he says really cool things. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie, you know, you know, but. What I was going to say is I really agree with you. I actually was really into Carse during, and the part of the reason I'm so keen to talk now is because we were only talking about Carse in the realm of the fourth book, which I think obviously is his book in some ways.
Yeah.
But also, I like Carse much more once Sam Ardev is introduced, because I think she is such an important foil, and pretty much everything she says, I'm way more on board with. And every time she's trying to cut Carse down to size, in my mind, she's almost always right. You know?
100%.
But anyway, that's and so it was kind of aggravating to continue to have that conversation. Not aggravating, but I wish I could talk about Sam Ardev or some of the stuff in Toll the Hounds when we're talking about Carse and my feelings on him, since, I don't know. It's like I'm only talking about a piece of the pie, you know?
Yeah, you have to be mad, cagey, and holding back. And I could even see that just in your regular House of Chains podcast episodes, because, you know, you're like, oh, that's interesting. Or when they like mention Traveler, right? And you can't say anything like that. But I think, you know, Sam Ardev, too, and that's the huge part of Carse. That's like one of the best relationships. Honestly, I love that, because they leave it till the very end. You know, I mean, by the time they actually get down to business, they have, you know, they didn't do that at the very beginning. They know each other. They've traveled together. She knows his good qualities, his bad qualities, their terrible qualities. They kind of have a much deeper bond before they ever go. So to me, that feels like such a really real and awesome and good, like that's how a real relationship actually is. You know what I mean? Like that felt real.
Yeah, I agree. Sam Ardev like sees through his persona and bluster, you know?
100%. And she's not fooled by it. And it's awesome, you know? And she takes him down. Like that's what you need. And especially a character like that with an ego like that, you know, it's like they need that kind of that grounding force. And she's like, yeah, I'm not impressed. She's like, you're full of, yeah, you're totally the bluster.
And I think that's why I've really I actually enjoy Carse in those parts of the book, but I never really buy, and I still haven't, his character change within House of Chains, which is such like an important part of this book. So I think that's what always like gummed me up on fully getting into the Carse train. But I want to return to exactly what you're saying about the opening passage, which I think I'm so into those beginning parts where it is about certainty. And I mean, he's just so unlikable in those parts.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's like clearly that's the point in a very sharp way. And something I know is in my mind, Steve attempts to address it later on, but it doesn't really connect with me, is that clearly in the beginning, he's like a horrific misogynist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he like talks about women interchangeably, rapes women all the time, and clearly has no regard or thinks of them as humans. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As people.
100%.
And when you talk about him trying to assert himself as a man and like prove himself through battle, all these things, I think there's a lot that could be being explored there about masculinity, you know, and how young men cling to violence and sexual violence and objectifying women to make themselves feel powerful, you know, very prescient stuff, you know.
Oh,
however,
yeah.
I don't feel like I have a good idea of what the system and gender standards are in the Teblor area and kind of the world in a bigger sense. I try to talk to Steve about this, but I don't know. I don't know if I articulated myself well, but I don't know. Like, is there a patriarchal system in the Teblor clans? If not, where does Carse get these ideas from? What do these ideas mean to Carse? You know? So I think when I really start to scrutinize what does this mean? I feel like I'm bringing our ideas of masculinity here on Earth into the story, and I don't really know what masculinity means to Karsa in the world. So I don't know. I feel this disconnect then between our world and what the book is world is, you know? So yeah. I think that just comes from how sex and power are built in the setting. But yeah, I don't know. That opening passage is what I liked most when rereading this book.
Totally. And I think that's why I love the stuff with his dad and his grandpa, too, because I think that is like kind of those only context clues that you kind of get for, you know, for me, I think the, you know, you have the kind of like 1970s, like flower child rebelling against like the 1950s, like baby boomer type.
Yeah.
Parent dynamic going on with the grandpa and the dad, and kind of, you know, the dad ends up being, I think, by the end, you know, kind of the one who's like, right. But I think, you know, he's kind of trying to live up to some mythological, you know, I think it's a very topical, but like there's a lot of social commentary in this book for today's time. I don't know exactly what
I fully agree. I think, and that's what I like so much about that beginning section, is I think it's a really great picture of how young men can delude themselves into violence in the pursuit of glory and meaning in their lives, you know, and it encompasses a lot of those things. So that part in a vacuum, I really like. And I don't know, just maybe that change, I can't get into. So then I kind of disconnect because I don't feel like I've never bought that he moves away from this incredibly adolescent, like, no, fuck you, dad, I'm going to go kill people. Like, totally. I don't know. He's so contemptible in the beginning.
And he never fully relinquishes it, honestly. Like, let's be real. Towards the end, like, he still has a tear it all down kind of, you know, that's still the ultimate goal. And so there's still, like, a lot of ego there and stuff, even through all the transformation and whatever.
And Sam Ardev even brings that up with him. I forget the exact line, but she talks about how adolescent his solution to the problems of society are, you know, just like, well, we should have no people. Yeah, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Totally. And you know, it's like, in some ways, it's kind of an interesting parallel to Shadow Throne in some ways, right? Because they, you know, if you really think about it, like the whole arc, like they have a similar goal of just like accumulating or destroying the sources of power to kind of let the world go, you know, get on with themselves or whatever. But they're just going about it in completely different ways. And one is like, a tear it all down, kind of like you said, childish scenario. So he has a crazy arc and like the development from where he is that first day when he goes and prays in the field or whatever with the seven to where he is at the very end of the book where he's, you know, goes in and destroys Bidathal and saves the day and whatever is a lot, but he's still not this like, you know, it's not the full development.
No, I don't. I still think he has some work to do.
Right. There you go.
What else is something that stood out to you when you reread it or when you were looking back on House of Chains?
There is so much that happens. It's definitely the Karsa book. So like, and I think it's right that he was the first quote unquote book, you know, group of chapters or whatever. That was Karsa's story. I think it's interesting how, you know, you're reading through the first like couple hundred pages as a total first timer. You know, and he's talking about the children and stuff. And like, you are not realizing that the children are like the regular people. So that part was really cool. But I think beyond just the whole Karsa arc is like, for me, you kind of associate book six with the Bone Hunters. But there was a lot of Bone Hunter stuff. You know, and this is kind of like, for me, I love the Bone Hunters because I feel like, you know, in Gardens of the Moon, you get dropped in with the Bridge Burners. And those are, you know, if you look at the merch and stuff, like people have Bridge Burner stickers and people have like first in, last out tattoos and stuff. You know what I mean? So they're legendary and you get dropped in and they're, you know, but we're like kind of watching the formation of our bridge. You know, this is kind of like our bridge burners. Like if this is a meta book and we're supposed to be the ones, you know, opening up these bloodstained pages and whatever, then like these are our bridge burners that we're like kind of watching the forging of, whereas, you know, we're dropping in way late to the game with the bridge burners. And that part was badass because you kind of, you know, I don't know, thinking back on the whole 10 book arc, you think like book six is the Bone Hunter book, but really like a deliciously nice Bone Hunter chunk happens here. And actually this is where the Bone Hunters come from, is actually book four.
You're dead on. And Steve actually said something similar about how he really wanted to take a army from beginning to end, and he knew it kind of had to start in book four. Mm-hmm. You know, and furthermore, I think the Bone Hunters thing, also quick side note, Bottle, literally, yeah. My mind completely forgot, literally thought he was a character that started in the Bone Hunters, did not know he was in this book, and then I came back, and I was like, oh my god, Bottle's in this book, and then all the aerosol stuff was in this book too. I was like, I didn't know this was foreshadowed. I literally thought this was something that only came up in book six, so I was so surprised, and I was like, huh, just another thing I had forgot. Look at you, Steve, you know?
Yeah, it's because of the name, right? They call it the Bone Hunters, and you think that's where all the Bone Hunters nuggets happen. But it starts a lot earlier.
But see, that's what I was going to say, is that like the Bone Hunters thing is just one piece of it. And I think actually when you look at it, definitely stood out to me. I don't particularly care for this book, but so much of what's going to happen in the rest of the series is really set up in this book. And I mean, outside of some of the Lether stuff and like, you know, truly some of the end game 9-10 stuff, maybe isn't exactly set up here, but all of maybe like the protagonists are kind of really put into place, and then like kind of we get a bigger picture of a lot of the cosmology stuff.
Yeah.
So it does really feel like it's sowing a lot of seeds that are going to be reaped, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 books later.
Oh yeah, 100%. Even like in the Bone Hunters, you know, I mean, they're like forging themselves now, and then they go through Yucatan like two books later. Even like the Troll and Onrak stuff, right? Like the Troll. Yeah. Defending the Shadow Throne stuff. There is so much stuff that, you know, it kind of feels like this is Karsa's book, but that really, there's three other books in House of Chains that are so full of stuff that matters. I think the, you know, Hounds of Shadow stuff, the callbacks, you know what I mean? Back to like the Gardens of the Moon stuff, where Ganos goes into Dragneepor and how he becomes the Master of the Deck in Memories of Ice, even though it's like a totally different book. There's a lot of callbacks and foreshadowing forward. It's not my favorite either. I was saying that I like, it's interesting. If you look at the Goodreads ratings for all the various Malazan books, like House of Chains is actually pretty high. And I think there's like, that's where the bias starts to kick in of the people who made it through the first three books.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I think at a certain point, I think people make a decision whether they're going to go the distance or not, you know? And, you know, I think that's, I don't know, it takes people a few books to figure that out, I think. Because I always felt like, you know, I read book 7 and kind of bounced off it in some ways. I'm really keen to revisit that book, but I had come that far. Do you mean, like, I was going to read the other three books, you know? I guess book 7 could have been, like, really, I don't know, it would have had to get really, really bad for me to stop. You know, I was pretty bought in.
Right.
So,
although Dust of Dreams gets bagged on pretty hard too, but this one also foreshadows stuff that's like not even happened yet. So like when, you know, he rapes those first couple of, you know, the war chief's wife or whatever, you know, that's going to be, you know, they show up, I guess, at the end of Toll the Hounds or whatever, but that's going to be, if you've read the prologue, because I think he posted that for the God is Not Willing, I think that's them. And then, you know, there's just all those people who are left in the wake. So,
and I'm actually really interested in learning, because I think their presence in Toll the Hounds, because like, I think there'd be an argument to be made, and I think that this argument could be made about the Karsa killing Bidathal thing, that these are supposed to be answers or showing how Karsa's coming to terms with his past of sexual violence and misogyny, you know? But as I said, I don't really feel like I have a good context for what that sexual violence and misogyny really means to him or to the world. And I don't know, like, they feel like gestures towards reconciliation and not actually doing the hard work of change. I mean, it, like, it's not like he was kind of a bad guy. Like,
oh,
he was, like, you know, it was very extreme. And, and that's why, I don't know, I'm actually would be very keen on I would hope this is a part of the forthcoming Carsa stuff.
Yeah.
Is that those, his children would be something to be further explored. And I would guess it would be. I feel like, I don't know. That's my suspicion, at least.
Yeah, definitely. I don't feel like there was any resolution to that piece at all. I feel like that was more of like a holy shit moment, like where that was the very, very beginning of the process kind of for him to come to, you know, because I feel like that was never a part of his character arc, was like, oh, my God. And I also like did this really terrible stuff to women. You know what I mean? Like that wasn't.
Yeah.
A part of it, you know, it was more just like he saw more of the machinations of the world, and obviously it wasn't as kind of like black and white as what he originally thought it was. But yeah, I love the idea of not having him in the first books too, because for me that's like the bigger thing. It's like, let's look at that freaking trail of carnage that he left and what that did, and like they're gonna, you know, try and make him, not instead of one of the seven, he's gonna be one of the eight now, and you have like Ublalapa, you know, and he's gonna have raise his army and come and be ready to rock and roll. But like, what the hell did he do, and how did that impact all these? I love that angle.
And I think something that has been brought up is that the timeline for those kids doesn't make sense. I know there's a lot of questions about the timeline in Toll the Hounds, yeah, including with Harlow.
Yeah, Harlow. But
some of the timeline inconsistencies are stuff that, honestly, I haven't scrutinized that much because it just isn't that important to me as a reader. Yeah. I know it is for some people. It isn't for me. So, if that's Chaser Bliss, you know, if that's something, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like Midnight Tides for me, too. Like, and same. Like, for me, I take
it. Yeah, some people say that, right?
Right. Like, I don't know exactly when all the shenanigans and they go hunting down, glaciers and stuff like that was. Years-wise, I don't line up all the years of Burn's sleep. And there is no year of Burn's sleep, I guess, in Lether. But for me, you know, it's I guess, I take it as a given. And Harlow's like 7 or 8 or 9 or however old. So there is a chunk of time that's gone by from the end of Memories of Ice. And we don't know how long it took him to leave his camp to, you know, there's a lot of flashing forward and stuff. So that's not the part that bothers me at all.
Yeah, I feel like I'm looking at it like, you know, at a distance. And I don't really need to squint to figure it out. I feel good out here, you know.
Yeah. I'm with
but
you.
We were talking about how it's a lot of setup for a lot of things, and I think part of what actually leaves me out of the cold in this book is that I think a lot of the setup involves a lot of separate storylines that aren't actually always that prescient to what's going on at hand. Mm. I mean, Troll and Onrak, I think, are related to the book thematically, but, you know, have very little to do with what's actually going on in this book, you know, outside of, you know, they share a lot of the same burdens that some other characters do in an emotional way.
Right.
So, I don't know. And between that and some of the Traveler stuff, which, you know, can feel like a sidetrack if you're actually, we're talking about a plot, like trying to move forward very quickly.
Right.
Which, I wouldn't say that's always what these books are about. So it's not, I don't know, the worst thing, but I just, we're spread out pretty far sometimes. And I think there, I kind of get off the same page of the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's still like a lot of seeds to plant, you know, like I could see the, when you're introducing Troll, like this is really the setup for Midnight Tides, right? And to be able to, in kind of, in some ways, this is the kind of logical next step or prequel to Deadhouse Gates, and you see Toblakai there when Shae gets assassinated or whatever, and then this goes back and tells the original story. Then you get like that, you know, that's kind of Troll becomes the bodyguard number two or whatever of House of Chains, that then later gets explored down the road. But like, if you think of House of Chains, you're not thinking of the Troll and Onrak book, really. That's not what springs to front of mind. But once you introduce Troll and Onrak, then I could see, then you got to kind of do the Traveler, Cutter, all that defending the throne kind of piece, because then that definitely becomes the big thing down the road.
Yeah, and that's planting a lot of seeds too. And I think that's how I would put it, is that sometimes I think this book spends more time planting seeds
yeah.
than like telling a single story that resonates with me, you know? And I don't know. I think that's where it loses me. I think it tries to tell a single story. I just never really get that on board with it, you know?
Yeah, and there's a couple of threads, you know, it's weird because like a lot of threads spiral out from House of Chains, but there is like an attempt to kind of bring some together too, and there's that weird kind of, you know, it feels like a conflict. Sometimes.
No, it's true, and Steve made this point, which is obviously true, that and some people will call either this book or the end of book five kind of the end of the setup books, you know? I don't know. This is definitely the end of a first cycle, if you will.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I also could see drawing it at the end of five after you've introduced Lether, you know?
That's kind of how I feel. I feel like, you know, one is one. And that was like he said before he even knew he was going to have other books or be able to go to 10 books. But then you have like Deadhouse Gates and then you have like House of Chains, which goes back and explores some of the beginnings of that and then sets the stage for the future, and then you have like the Memories of Ice stuff, and Midnight Tides is where you go back and explore the beginnings of some of the seeds laid in House of Chains, and then it kind of starts to somewhat thread together until you get to Dust of Dreams.
Yeah, I feel like in Bone Hunters is when you really start to get what the plot is. And then I feel like at the end of Bone Hunters, you're like, okay, I get it. I get what we're doing. We're all going to Lether. Everyone's together. Let's go to the same place.
Yes. You
know? And I don't know, part of me then feels like that's why I was a little aggravated with the seventh book, because I actually was so stoked to have the conflict between all these people. And then the seventh book's like, I don't know, I almost expected the first page to start with all of it, but there was like a lot of buildup and a lot of other stuff, you know? But that's for the future anyway.
Yeah.
Ugh. I gotta say, I know your whole Malazan content system's a little different, you know, because you're on less of kind of a schedule, you know?
Yeah.
We're like going through the books in sequence. And going into this book, I was like, I don't really know what to do because I kind of knew I wasn't that into this book, you know, and here we are going to talk about it for a while. And, you know, I don't know. I don't have that much to say besides that, you know, I like it less than some of the other books, you know, but it makes me very keen to move on to book five, a book I like quite a lot.
Yep.
And I don't know, it's kind of interesting to have to go through in sequence, you know?
Yeah. No, I like going through it. For me, this is one of my lower rated. I hate to rate the books. I even read the books on the Kindle. I read them all 10 as one kind of.
Yeah, I think you said because they have one of those big super PDFs.
Anthology
things, right?
Yeah, things. Yeah. And it's which I paid for, Steve. I did. But, you know, I read them all as one big giant book, but this one is one of my lower rated, but I do like and I love going through Deadhouse Gates again, because I think, you know, for me, Felicin is a challenging character in Deadhouse Gates for me personally to like overwrite my initial kind of reaction, which is like, you know, because we're privy to so much as a reader information that she doesn't have and whatever. And so like for me, House of Chains was cool to revisit that because now she's in a totally different, you know, she's not Deadhouse Gates Felicin, she's Shake. And so there's a lot of dynamics there. And then there's also like a lot of the tough stuff, like the sexual violence stuff with Bitathal and Felicin Jr. And that makes this book, I think, really controversial. Like Bitathal is one of the most hated characters, if you ask my Discord, you know, like even above like people who've gone borderline genocide status, just because his, you know, as an individual is a absolutely despicable, terrible person.
Yeah.
And there, I think there's a lot of, not to cut you off, but I think there's a big social commentary potentially there as well. Like, what is the more sinister thing to kind of be on the lookout or be on guard for is like the really terrible, like Bitathal, Jeffrey Epstein-esque type, just disgusting, despicable, nothing good about him, or like the more, you know, strategic, like ends justify the means type, like, you know, Malik Reles, who will sacrifice 40, 50, 70,000 people, you know, because he's got an axe to grind but got a better ultimate plan.
I think you're dead on. And in that, I think part of an effect is that since we witnessed Bitathol's abuse firsthand, you know, that's very powerful, it leaves a powerful effect on the reader.
Yeah.
You know? And I think the same thing happens in book nine, is that since that's such a powerful sequence we experience so viscerally, you know, I don't know. I think I end up feeling so harshly against those abusers because of how that's witnessed firsthand. And that's to contrast against, like, you know, Kalor, obviously an incredibly bad person, you know? And, you know, I don't know how to do moral ethics math to determine who's worse. I don't know if that's a game you even get into. They're both bad. But my point is, I guess, Kalor, at least, I would say we're almost removed from a lot of the bad stuff he does. And we kind of actually spend most of time with him in a kind of, like, in this kind of more elderly, dejected, weird phase of his life, as opposed to when we are led to believe he was, like, the worst dictator and slaves and all, you know, just all this horrific stuff. So yeah, I think it's interesting how you experience these characters' atrocities can affect where you come to as a reader.
Absolutely. You know, I'm like, the we weren't there and we don't witness it firsthand the way that you do. And, you know, you're kind of, you experience Felis and the Younger through Shake's eyes from the very first, as like, hey, this is the chance to, like, not have all the shenanigans that happened to me play out. And she can, you know, I'm going to take in this orphan. She doesn't have to be this guard in my camp. She can come and express her poetic talents or whatever other, you know, linguistic skills and all that stuff that she had, and not have to go through all these shenanigans. But you know, Memories of Ice, Kalor, like, isn't a good dude, right? Like, the Memories of Ice prologue Kalor, right? Like, hundreds of thousands of years ago, where he's just, like, burned an entire continent to the ground, where it took extreme elder god intervention to try and repair, like, you know, he can become less evil, I think, but people are always like, yeah, Kalor is my boy, and same with Karsa. It's like, but he never becomes, like, a good dude, though.
No, of course not. And I think that's part of always why I've had such a strong effect, a strong almost aversion to Karsa, because of how viscerally those chapters are written in the beginning. But to actually build on this Shaik point, I actually think it's kind of a big contrast, because although this is a follow-up to Dead House Gates, I would say, you know, in some ways, Dead House Gates, Felicin is maybe the main character. I don't really think there is a main character, but I would say it's like Chain of Dogs, Felicin, and then kind of the Path of Hands plotline, right? But I feel like people talk about Felicin. I feel like if they talk about Dead House Gates, they talk about Felicin or they talk about the Chain of Dogs. Mm. They're the two things people talk about. And I think it's because Felicin takes up a lot of the emotional space, and she goes on a very big journey in that book. And she's very, I don't know, for some people, she's a challenging character, you know? And I think in the same, when I first read House of Chains, maybe I was disappointed that you don't return to Felicin and she continues to be a primary character. You know, you return to Shaik, and Shaik's a very different type of character in the story. And I don't know. I actually end up feeling like I really like that decision. And I think it's a really interesting choice and an interesting way Steve handled the story.
I agree with you. And I think it's just part of the kind of empathy and what he's trying to show us is that you know, there is a lot of pain and stuff out there. And you never get
she's become a new person.
Right. And you never get that happy ending where let me, you know, buy this and take it for good and get past and whatever. And it's like it. And you see that dichotomy all the way up to that point, right? Like, she's got an internal monologue that's totally different than what she's putting out to the rest of the world. And then you pick up in House of Chains and it's like that part's gone. You know, it's like one side of that, you know, if you have like the angel and the devil on your shoulder, it's like one side has clearly kind of won. And I think that's a commentary, honestly, on like all the religious stuff throughout the whole books too. You know, it's like if you look at the whole religions and the fact that the Cripple God like really exploits like a lot of the corrupt religions and figureheads in these I don't know, whatever it is, the pantheon of ascendance and whatnot.
Sure.
And this is part of that, right? Like, this is a broken one. And if you track this back to all the stuff with Onrak, right, and is, you know, and where the whirlwind comes from, it's, you know, it's the same kind of deal that we see throughout the whole rest of the series.
Yeah, I think I love Toll the Hound, and I think Toll the Hound has religion on its mind, you know? And I think I would like to ask Steve about his relationship to faith, because I would say faith is a part of the books, but I think almost more than faith is a part of the books, talking about the structures of religion and how organized religion affects people's lives is a bigger part of the book than what faith and belief means. I don't know. It's something I've really been reading for, because I think I think about that with a character like Hiborik, who does feel like a spiritual man who has faith, you know, and that's a part of who he is, you know? So I'm keen to talk to Steve about that one day, but, you know, it's not the biggest thing in House of Chains. So we had a lot to talk about besides that. So
yeah, exactly.
And then the final thing I maybe wanted to touch on was, you know, I talked about how aggravating it was to talk about Karsa without being able to talk about the big picture. And I had a similar experience talking about Tavor, you know, who we essentially know nothing. The reader knows nothing about her in this book.
Or
you know?
Either that or they hate her.
Yeah. Right. And like she's a very removed character. And then, I don't know, we all had kind of fun dunking on her for, killing Felicin.
Yeah.
But it's difficult because although I hold her fully responsible for sending Felicin into slavery, I don't think that was the right decision, all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. But I ultimately feel very good about her character, and I'm very pro Tavor, but it's like hard to talk about it since, I don't know, we've only met her in like the, 12 chapters she's in House of Chains, do you mean? And
yeah.
I feel like you learn a lot more about her, and I don't know, I actually feel like you only more in like Dust of Dreams you start to get a picture, and then really in the Crippled, do you mean? She's a very at distance figure, you know?
100%. Yeah. And I think he even said that she is the one who's kept the most distant. What's interesting to me is like the contrast between her and Lassine, because they're both like these cold, distant, kind of icy, cold hearted whatevers. But, you know, by the end, we come around on Tavor, because even though she did all this stuff to her sister and that never panned out, like she did have, all this. She's like arguably the one who symbolizes the empathy and the compassion of the book the most, right? Because she took all this stuff on. But we don't have that same kind of thing for Lassine, who was like arguably trying to do the same stuff and just she screwed it up, right? And didn't actually achieve and alienated all of her people. But she had a ends justify the means type of argument to what she was thinking too.
I think it's an interesting contrast you're drawing. But I think it's a little different, because I think Lassine is ultimately bearing a lot as a leader and as a woman for her own ego and her own pursuit of expansion and herself, you know? And I think Tavor as a person is much more like, she is so burdened and she is so weighed down by all these decisions that are not about her ego. It is about a type of compassionate, redemptive love. And I think that is why she kind of sits at that emotional fulcrum at the end of the series, and kind of slowly more weight gets put onto her throughout the rest of the, as you build up to it, you know?
Yeah. And maybe that's what he's saying, right? Is that you got to let all that stuff go. Like you got to, you know, that was maybe Lassine's pitfall, was that she still, she still had herself in the equation as like a critical component of the overall vision versus like the, you know, being a true kind of ride or die or for the cause or whatever, you know what I mean? Like Tavor wasn't even, and that's kind of like the whole point of the book. If you think about it being a book of the fallen written by Kamenzad to honor these unsung, you know, heroes who did all the stuff, like that's kind of the whole point, was that she did it like knowing that they weren't going to, you know, it wasn't for any of that stuff.
No, it's not. And I think that's why I actually find it quite biblical in a way. I think it is a type of compassionate, selfless love is what Steve's really trying to write about with Tavor and her willingness to sacrifice ultimately.
Yeah, totally. And I think honestly, like without going super crazy, you know, political. I think it's challenging us to, you know, especially if this is supposed to be some kind of a meta narrative where someone's reading this Book of the Fallen and that someone isn't necessarily someone in the Malazan world going in and picking up Kamenzad's book in a library. It might like actually be us reading about some other world and challenging us to kind of do that too, you know, to like look at the cause, quote unquote, of our strife, right? Like the crippled god or whatever that is, the person who's infecting the Warrens, the person who's playing all these crazy, you know, games, and to not look at them and attack them, right? Like everybody else was trying to do in one way or the other, or figure out a way to wall them off or to defend against them or to take them out or to whatever, but to help them, right? But to understand them, but to free them. You know, and I think that's without trying to get too here and now, I think that's a powerful thing to be thinking about right now.
I agree. And I think that's in a lot of ways why the series has always resonated me at the end, because it challenges and questions the reader not to, I don't know. I don't think it's a book about justice or revenge, or these books are about redemptive violence, you know, which I think are a lot of things that happen when you write books about I don't know, armies clashing, you know? I mean, ultimately, the ultimate act that comes out of Tavor and this and what it builds up to is an act of love, and like an act of meeting your foes and trying to, I don't know, not destroy them, but to, I don't know, understand them and love them, you know? And I find it to be, I feel like the books challenge the reader to do that. And I think that's ultimately why, I don't know, really like the books, obviously. Why else do I have a fucking show about it? But you get the point.
Totally. No, it's deep stuff, you know, and I think it's important. And like, it's such a different thing. Like, think of the world that we would have if we looked at the sources of our problems that way instead of the way that we do.
And I think part of the reason, because, of course, you know, this isn't, you know, Steve's books are the only person to tell you this, right? But I think part of the reason I really like this is, I mean, part of, I don't know, like that's a fantasy story, like it's this kind of interesting type of fantasy story. And additionally, you know, that message about redemptive love and how to treat other people, I think is very powerful, you know? But I was pretty critical of how Steve wrote about sexual violence recently. And I stand by a lot of those criticisms, but I think part of what I appreciate about their inclusion in these books and inclusion in some of the pretty dark elements, I mean, these books are pretty, get pretty fucking grim sometimes, is that, like, I don't think Steve is got rose-warm glasses on about how the world works or how we should treat each other. You know, I think Steve is pretty clear-cut that, like, things are pretty bad a lot of the time, you know, and that people are pretty shitty to each other, you know? But I think because he portrays how dark everything is, this kind of optimistic, loving message that I feel like is actually at the heart of the books, I think resonates more with me, because I don't think he's playing coy with some of the darker parts of humanity.
Yeah, no. And I think that's what makes the hopeful parts, like, you know, it's uncomfortable, honestly, because I think, you know, and we talked about that, and I know this is a part of this book, but we did the whole, you know, Hitan thing, and we read the essay and talked about that in the Discord and stuff, and like, that stuff is terrible and controversial, and like, even the most like ride or die, you know, Erickson fans have issues with reading that and with the way that that's portrayed. And like, for me, the way, you know, I'm kind of in the camp of like, dude, that stuff happens, and like, there's terrible stuff happening, and not, you know, I think that's what makes the empathy and the compassion that people have in the face of that stuff powerful, is because like, it's a terrible world, and it's easy to be cynical and to get angry or whatever.
I agree, it's easy to be cynical, and I actually don't know how cynical these books are. I think they can be cynical about some things, but I don't think they're cynical about humanity, maybe. I don't know.
No, I think he's trying to take a very real look. Honestly, I think he's trying to say, like, dude, this stuff, you know, I think he's not putting a judgment on it. You know, I think he's saying, like, this stuff is here. What do we do about it? You know, how do we respond? I love that essay. If you go back and read the Dust of Dreams response about the snake, in, and how, you know, the struggles of the refugee train and all of that stuff, and just, you know, how people did were like, why are we learning something new, and why are, you know, we focusing on these people who, you know, let's just get on with the kind of conclusion of what happened with the Bone Hunters and things like that, I think is on point, because he's asking us to continue to challenge ourselves and to really like hold ourselves accountable.
And I think that is a great way, as I opened by saying, I think I'm a bit more of a moral scold than Steve is. Great way to loop it around. You know, it was all planned from my poorly thought out opening. Is I agree. I think the books are often not that judgmental. I do think sometimes Steve has a habit of offering answers or wisdom or, I don't know, Steve's thoughts. You know, that's definitely Steve-isms. Something in the book. Yeah. But... And those things always resonate less with me, and I actually always like it more than when we're talking about these things, and I think the book is posing questions and pressing you on what do you think, how do you feel about these things, you know? So, yeah. And I think the book does that a fair amount, so I think that's all, those always resonate with me a good deal. But... Oh, you're going to say anything? Or are we good?
No, I was just going to say it always gets me introspecting, and that's what I like about it. It's like you can be told a story or you can live the story. And so for me, that's why I keep coming back.
That's exactly right. Well, listen, it was a great time talking House of Chains. I mean, once again, I don't know. I have no memory of what we talked about in the Memories of Ice spoiler cast, so maybe that one was more focused. We were, I would say, quasi-focused. I don't know. We at least got to talk about several things. It's hard to talk about this sometimes.
The spoiler cast is fun because we can go wherever we want.
That's exactly right. It's free roaming. So I have a quick thing to announce, but first I wanted to say, email us at 10verybigbooks, pretend very big books on Twitter, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're on Discord, blah, blah, blah. Leave us a review, tell a friend, you get it, blah, blah. So anyway, so what I was going to say is this summer we started a Patreon and it's allowed us to cover some more extra things on the show. And those bonus episodes are out there. And then some of them are made public. Me and Josh read beginning of all the Gardens of the Moon epigraphs. We've been talking about them. And we're going to start the Dead House Gate ones, I think, in late October, early November, something like that. Furthermore, I'm excited. Me and Iskar here are going to talk through the Esselmont books as a series of podcasts. And I'm very keen. The two of us are going to hang out, you know, talk about Esselmont. It'll be a good little time. And we're going to start with Knight of Knives in December and then probably proceed through the series about going through one every about 2 or 3 months or so. Probably closer to 3, but you can check and we'll tweet and let people know where we are with it. And I think our goal for the series, what we've been talking about, is probably to try and contextualize these books in terms of the whole series, but then talk about what these books actually mean on their own as their separate thing and how we feel about them going through them again. Iskar's read through all 6 of them. I've actually only read through the first 3, and I'm sure that's something we will discuss on the show, but you can look for that in December. So... thank you so much for coming on again, Iskar. It was a pleasure.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me back. It's always a blast to be able to nerd out on the books. Even though House of Chains isn't my favorite, there's some juicy nuggets to talk about. So it was a lot of fun.
Plenty of nugs. All right, everybody. It was a good conversation. Let us know what you think. See ya.